This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community. Here's another Saturday Magazine podcast brought to you by Joy sponsor, Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
This is Saturday Magazine.
You're on Saturday Magazine, Paul and Fiona holding the fort, Dylan on the decks, and it's a beautiful sunny day outside. Thanks for listening. We have sitting right next to us now a regular guest, Matt Wade from the Star Observer. Thanks for coming in, Matt.
Yeah, no problem. Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Good morning, Matt.
Hi.
Have you been and what's in the news this week?
There's a lot going on in the news this week, actually. Around, actually, particularly in Victoria, obviously the state election is impending. It's looming in the distance. So a lot of community groups at the moment are trying to gauge what, I guess, the community's priorities are in terms of issues they'd like tackled or what they want politicians to consider going into the election. So actually tonight, I don't know if Victorian listeners are available, but at St Kilda Town Hall, the Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby are holding a candidates forum where they'll have someone from each party and they're going to actually ask them about particular issues to gauge how they feel about particular things, what their priorities are. And then the lobby will put together a kind of report card for each party and grade them based on, you know, their thoughts on everything from education to health to family violence to homelessness.
Well, that's a fantastic initiative.
I hope the candidates have done their homework. That's a pretty tall order.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot to answer for in there. And it would be so, I mean, I love the idea of grading them.
Yeah, it's kind of good. Like in the previously, actually, Star Observer, and I think it was with RMIT, we used to do this thing where we'd grade universities, so tertiary education, on like how they were in terms of LGBTI inclusivity, and we'd mark it off against parameters like, do they have a pride group, and do they this, that, and the other? Do they have courses around that kind of thing, like gender and sexuality? And it was really important, and people really responded to it. So this is actually really great because the lobby put together a booklet with, I think, maybe 7 or 8 different community organisations. So it meant that, you know, people from Transgender Victoria and Bi Alliance Victoria were also contributing important issues to make sure that they were included. One thing that I thought was interesting, though, was the lobby was saying that obviously different community organisations have different priorities. So, of course, Bi Alliance are going to want to make sure bi visibility is a priority. Transgender Victoria are going to want to make sure, you know, teachers in schools are trained in trans inclusivity, that kind of thing. But the lobby was saying across all the organisations, the things that were the most consistent that they were saying across the board were education and family violence. So as much as obviously not to diminish the importance of other issues, those two are kind of the ones that have come up consistently as things people really want to see tackled by whoever is elected come November.
Well, I mean, education and safe schools is such a hot topic. And, you know, the Liberal Party, the Victorian Liberal Party, hasn't really made clear what they would replace safe schools with. I mean, we have talked to the Alana and Madeline Foundation about trying to get them on the program because they, the Liberal Party launched their anti-bullying campaign with the Alana and Madeline Foundation.
Of course.
But that's not to say that that foundation is associated with that anti-bullying project.
Sure. Well, I know that one of the recommendations by the lobby and the other groups, which was actually, and these recommendations were, even though they were put together by about 7 or 8 organisations, they were endorsed, I believe, by about 30 community organisations. Mm-hmm. So they're quite reflective, I guess, of where the community is at in terms of issues or what they want tackled. But one of the recommendations was calling on the Victorian government to commit to funding evidence-based, age-appropriate, inclusive sexuality education, as well as respectful relationships education, which is also an important thing, I think. They didn't actually mention the program Safe Schools, and I think that was, in my opinion, I feel like that was probably deliberate because they just more broadly are wanting something there, in whatever capacity it is, that is inclusive of LGBTI people.
You can almost feel, though, they excluded that and they tried to widen the agenda, so actually it looks like it's including elements of, say, schools and not encompassing the whole program.
Yeah, and I think it would be something that politicians, whichever party they're from, you would hope, would be more on board getting behind, because it doesn't have that kind of controversial, you know, undertone with it that Safe Schools has carried for the last few years.
Well, I mean, any education and respectful relationships benefits every sector. You know, young boys learning how to respect women, how to respect people from other cultures, and just, you know, it should help with the bullying in so many ways. If kids have just got some of those basics, things that you would always imagine they might get from home, but not necessarily.
Exactly. And it's one of those, it actually ties into the family violence issue as well, because I think, I mean, I know respect relationships is something that kids are kind of being taught in many places these days, but I mean, when I was in school, there was nothing like that. And I think it doesn't only, like you're saying, it doesn't only apply to heterosexual identifying students. You know, learning how to respect people regardless of their gender or if they even have a gender, you know, that's something that anyone can benefit from growing up if they're not necessarily getting that education in the household. So, yeah.
I mean, I think at primary school and it was really quite dog eat dog.
Yeah.
I mean, I went to a country primary school and it was a little bit vicious, I have to say. And then I went to an all-girls boarding school. Well, you can just imagine what
that
was. I
was going to say, surely that was a lot worse.
Yes, yeah, so, well, that sounds like it's going to be a very interesting event down there.
And I said, I wouldn't want to be one of those candidates. That's a pretty big shopping list of things you need to swat up on before you get in front of that audience.
Definitely. So, yeah, I guess listeners and obviously Joy and Star Observer will be keeping our eyes peeled for when those report cards are released, and they'll obviously be informed by tonight's discussion, but also I believe the lobby will be sending each of the parties a survey to complete as well, which coincides with those recommendations.
Oh, well, we definitely need to get the guys on, maybe Dale Park, on when those things have been collated so that we can talk about their outcomes. I think that'd be fantastic. One of the things I love was that ABC initiative where you could, during the election, before the election, where you can put in your concerns and it tells you what the party stands
is. Yeah, that was good.
I don't know what that was called, but that's a really great way for people to get educated about
the Vote Compass.
That's what it is.
Oh, that's right.
Dylan.
He's not just a pretty face, is he? So you were talking about country towns and growing up. Now, one of the things that was in the news was the most homophobic town and what's been going on since then. But you were talking about a fringe play you saw that reflected on what happens in country Victoria.
So all of my team at work decided to go and see this one particular show that stood out for us by a really fabulous performer called Selena Jenkins.
At Melbourne Fringe, was it?
At Melbourne Fringe. She, unfortunately, listeners, the show is finished last night. It was called Thy Neighbour. It's a song and dance, but not entirely. She's a great storyteller, and she speaks of her experiences, her partner they had in a small country town in Victoria, and the during the plebiscite when they were living there, and the horrors that were they experienced from their two neighbours, like the vile hatred and the disgusting behaviour that drove them quite mad. And you know, the emotion that came out during the performance, I mean, we were all like shell-shocked by the experience. And I had spoken to Selena beforehand and I'd asked her, is she okay to name the town? And she said, I named the town in the show.
Oh, right.
And then when she told me the name of the town, I was like, but I know some gay friends that live in that town. And she said, well, you know, she says in the play that they chose that town because it was gay friendly.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I think obviously we all were very much exposed to a lot of the vitriol and discrimination that people in our community faced over those months late last year. But I honestly believe that only scratched the surface. Like, and that's a testament to that because I don't. Well, that story wasn't broadcast last year, was it?
Not that I know of. She said that she had. She did a tour and she did a sort of a light witty version of it.
Right.
But what was the most homophobic town?
What have they done about it?
So in the 90s, it's actually a town in Tasmania called Ulverston. And basically, it was dubbed in the early 90s the most homophobic town in Australia for a number of reasons. But primarily because at the time, Tasmania was fighting for decriminalisation of homosexuality. And the council at the time, which was the Central Coast Council, were putting forward motions encouraging other councils to fight against decriminalisation. Mm-hmm. There was also, I believe, a couple in the neighbourhood, a gay couple who ran one of the markets, and they were the victims of like a homophobic attack. Oh, not a physical attack, but in terms of, vitriol and discrimination. But it's changed a lot. And actually, at one point, so this is important to note as well, at one point, the Lonely Planet Guide actually advised LGBTI people not to visit the town. Like, that's how much it was, even though, you know, it may seem like inconsequential. It's a small town somewhere in Tasmania.
That's a pretty big call.
Yeah, it's actually, on the guide, it was listed somewhere just to avoid if you're LGBTI. And so, yeah, recently, over the last week or so, the council, I mean, it shows how far they've come, but they have put forward a motion to not only acknowledge the hurt that they caused back in the day to LGBTI people, but to also actually work to champion and support them now through a number of different initiatives, like being a part of Tasmanian Pride Festival, even planting trees to acknowledge LGBTI heroes, things like that. So
that is a good news story.
Yes.
One of the things I was interested in from the Star Observer this week was a gay man who had come out as being bisexual.
Yes.
And what he had to say about that.
Yeah, it was interesting because the young man, Steve, he, I think over the course of this year, has gradually come out as bisexual to the people in his life. And in the lead up to Bi Visibility Day, as Dylan mentioned earlier, which is this Sunday, he's been putting stuff out there to encourage the acceptance of bisexual people, but has copped actually a lot of backlash from friends and just people in the community alike, I guess denying the validity of his identity, making jokes about it. And because of that, he wrote this piece for us, which essentially was saying that for a lot of gay men, I mean, he can speak from that experience, of course, that then come out as bisexual, a lot of people don't take it seriously, or they invalidate it, or they even harass him about it. So it's an interesting thing to note, because bi invisibility is very real, and bi erasure is very real. But when somebody, I guess, initially comes out as gay or lesbian or whatever it may be, and then actually self-identifies as bisexual after that, it's a whole different experience, because people have become used to you being a particular, identifying as a particular way, and so it's hard for some people to be as accepting or embracing because of that, which is, it's awful. So it was a really powerful piece, because he was just really highlighting that there are plenty of bisexual people that he knows and in his life, including himself, who have had to go to certain measures to self-censor and hide certain parts of himself to avoid that ridicule or harassment. So he was saying, for example, some bisexual men might hire sex workers or something like that, because it's kind of behind closed doors and he doesn't have to talk about it openly with people in his life, because he fears that something like that might happen, like he might get harassed or invalidated. So yeah, it's really interesting.
When we did the outside broadcast at Mercedes Me a couple of weeks ago, we had Ruby Mountford on, who runs the show here on Joy, and she was talking about her projects working on Bi Visibility Day. It was really interesting to hear what she had to say.
And she actually wrote something for us about a month ago or so, and it was interesting because, and this is a very real problem, I mean, generally, broadly in Australia and in the community, broadly in Australia, I should say, a lot of people, invalidate bi identities, but within the community, it's an issue as well, and that's what Ruby had pointed out with us as well, was that it's hard, you know, when people talk about the LGBTI community, it's held up as this thing that's very inclusive and welcoming. Well,
it's a bunch of labels, to be fair. Yeah. That's what the acronym stands for, and I think, you know, what we're saying is that that article represents is that there's a fluidity on that dial, and, you know, some people in some years just tend to move up and down.
And unfortunately, if somebody were to identify, say, for example, bisexual, there are parts of the community that might not necessarily make them feel welcome because they're, for whatever reason. And it's a problem within the community as well.
Mm. And you can listen to Australia's best bisexual show on Joy. It's Triple Bypass, presented by Ruby, Anthony and James and Jen. That's Tuesdays 9 to 10 Australian Eastern Standard Time. Or you can download their podcast on your preferred platform or by visiting joy.org.au. /Triple Bypass.
I said Dylan is so on the button this morning.
Yeah, I'll say. We just went down a whole bi sort of little laneway there. Now,
can we talk Mardi Gras?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say too.
This is a great story. What's this about, Matt?
I guess this is a bit of a controversial one. And it's not actually new necessarily, because there have been people that obviously have this view for quite some time. But Mardi Gras hold their board elections during their AGM, which is in October, I believe. And there's a group that's kind of put themselves forward to be considered, called Pride in Protest. And I guess if elected, their platform or what they'd like to achieve is essentially to ban police, the Liberal Party, and corporations. Those are the main kind of three groups from the Mardi Gras parade, along with a slew of other things. I guess they don't want, they want the floats in the parade to be exclusively for community groups and not-for-profit groups. Mm-hmm. And they also want to eliminate a membership fee for Mardi Gras so that people don't have to pay. And it's interesting, and I guess overall, overarching all of that, they want to kind of revert Mardi Gras back to its protest kind of origins. So obviously initially it was very much about speaking out about LGBTI rights, and it's shifted understandably into more of a pride and celebratory thing. But this group in particular wants to change it back and just make it a more of a straightforward protest.
That's an interesting set of demands. I just wonder, with all those proposed, and I haven't read this article, did they come with a list of here's all the costs of Mardi Gras and these are our proposals to fund them?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
It's interesting because whenever we've written something, well, for the most part, when we write about Mardi Gras, our readership, which covers a broad cross-section of the community, is quite divided. So there are obviously those who, similar to yourself, Paul, are saying, you know, well, we obviously need... Well, A, we need monetary support to make it the big event that it is, but B, it's actually important to show that people like the police and corporations or whatever are on side and that we have allies in those spaces.
Mm. They're part of the community as well.
Well, and that's the part. And I actually asked when I was interviewing them, what about LGBTI members that are police officers or that support the Liberal Party or that work at ANZ or wherever it may be? And they were essentially saying they're welcome to still march, but just not on behalf of those places. So, like, they can march in another float as part of a... You know, that might be their values, but they can't march as part of that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. They could be the slightly outcast kind of.
Well, that's what I was. That's what I was asking.
It's like
we
work for an anonymous corporation. We just can't say who.
But I also think that the success of Mardi Gras over the last 40 years has been about the celebratory change in the nature of the event. So for sure, it started off where people were trying to fight for rights to get visibility of LGBTI issues. But now it should be a celebration of actually we're on the journey and it's getting better. Mm. Well, hopefully, if Scott Morrison doesn't get too involved, but it's the right direction of travel. I think trying to return it to a protest route would almost be undermining all the great work that's taken place in the last 40 years.
Look, you know, I mean, credit to them to stand up and say what they, you know, would like for Mardi Gras, but it's obviously a really big ask. I mean, how do you run a huge event like that without the corporate funding and support?
Exactly. And I think it's one of those things where I worry that if hypothetically that were to happen, I feel like it would isolate a lot of members of the community who feel that they're not welcome there because for whatever reason they would like it to be more of a pride march or they work at a corporation or they are happy with allies in the police, things like this. So,
and Matt, to your point, we just had a message in from 317, thank you for your message, saying that this group is not being inclusive but exclusive and they're just as dogmatic as the groups they want to exclude and it's just not sensible in a capitalist society. So I think, you know, very much to your point, they're making it exclusive.
Yeah, I understand to a certain point that, you know, they're kind of saying that priority they feel is being given at the moment to groups that historically have undermined the community and it really should be a focus on the community. But I think there's a balance that can be found. And I think that there can still be protest elements in the parade, and there are. I mean, I marched this year, the group that I marched in was a political kind of satire float that was kind of calling out some of the homophobic and transphobic politicians in Australia and around the world. So there still is a space for it to be political. There's a space for it to be a pride and celebratory thing. But yeah, I wonder how feasible it is to remove all of that kind of funding and sponsorship because, I'm not sure what would happen after that.
So maybe looking outside of our shores, you did have a story about paying it forward for the community.
That's right. Yeah. So at the moment, Taiwan is actually looking to face a national vote on marriage equality, similarly to how we did. And Australian marriage equality, like the ones that ran the equality campaign last year, are kind of calling on Australia to, I guess, pay it forward in a sense, like you said, and help out our neighbours with their campaign if it does eventuate. Because initially it looked like the parliament was on side with marriage equality in Taiwan, but then a handful of, well, I say handful, I think it was like 100 or 200,000 people in Taiwan did this protest and petition, and they managed to push for a vote instead. And Alex Greenwich from the Equality Campaign or Australian Marriage Equality is basically saying, you know, we know how hard it was to A, fund a yes campaign here in Australia, because obviously a lot of the religious groups that were against marriage equality had a lot more money. So they're kind of saying, similarly to over there, that if we can help pitch in, and they've raised, I think, about $10,000 or so to help out with the campaign over there. And we obviously know, as we were talking earlier, about how terrible it can be during that process for people in the community. So if we can support them anyway, I mean, that can only be helpful.
Definitely. I think they need to raise more than $10,000.
Yeah. Well, that's right. I remember even feeling at the time my naive mind, but I was like, oh, you know, the Qantas CEO pitched in $1 million for the Yes campaign. That's great. Like, that's a massive figure. But then you hear about the No campaign just having heaps of money channeled in by, you know, whether it's the ACL or religious groups or Liberal, whatever, whoever it may have been. But it definitely requires a lot of money to get the word out there.
Well, we wish them luck.
And just on one last topic, just talking about people from outside our shores, there was also one more article there, Matt, about a queer refugee woman and the fact that they're an invisible minority here in Australia. What was that story?
Yeah, so, I mean, over the last year or so, I think increasingly people in the community have tried to recognise that there are gay and bisexual men, asylum seekers, I should say, on Manus Island. Mm-hmm. There was a group that was formed in Melbourne late last year called No Pride in Detention, and they've marched at rallies to kind of draw awareness to the fact that asylum seekers aren't just heterosexual. You know, people in our community are trying to seek asylum for that because they face homophobia or whatever it may be. However, that conversation is always centred around gay and bisexual men when it comes to LGBTI refugees. No one ever really refers to refugee women. So Tina and Renee Dixon, who are a same-sex couple in Australia, and they've also sought refuge here in Australia previously, about maybe 10 years ago, they've created this group called the Queer Sisterhood Project, and the idea is for it to be a safe space for queer refugee women to come together, but also for their voices to be heard, because yeah, they very much, when they arrived here in Australia, they felt invisible. There was no one that understood their experience. There was nowhere they could find adequate support, because just no one knew how to effectively handle queer refugee women. It's just an unrecognized minority. So hopefully with this group and increasing visibility through media and whatever it may be, people can come to understand that A, there are queer refugee women that exist, but also that the discrimination they faced or that they're fleeing from whatever their home country might be, doesn't end when they get into Australia. That was another important point, that, you know, when LGBTI people seek refuge somewhere, it doesn't just magically disappear when they arrive in, say, Australia, because there are homophobic people here too. There are policies here that are homophobic or transphobic. So their story doesn't end once they've sought refuge. It very much continues, and it's important to recognise and try to support that as well.
I can imagine it would just be ongoing and, you know, the recovery from going through the refugee process, and it would be certainly a journey.
But it must be traumatic, you know,
really
trying to rebuild your life at the best of times without having to worry about, how you fit into that community of refugees. You know, it must be so isolating.
And that's it. When I think it was Tina was saying, because she was undertaking a PhD and she did this kind of 3-day retreat, and that was before the Queer Sisterhood Project was born. But a bunch of queer refugee women went on this retreat, and at the end of it, they were all kind of like, we've never been somewhere where we feel comfortable both speaking about our experiences as queer, sorry, as refugee women, but also as being queer as well. And that's why then the Sisterhood Project was born, because they thought, well, this is obviously critical. You know, if they don't feel comfortable talking about their refugee experience with straight refugees, and they also don't feel comfortable talking about their experience in the LGBTI community, then some sort of intersection like this is needed. So yeah, it's really important.
Matt, as always, thank you for your contribution.
Anytime, thank you.
There's a great diverse piece of content that's coming out of the Star Observer, so you and the team are doing a fantastic job there.
Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, proudly sponsored by Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.